Blog Talk Radio. For lively discussions and great networking with product professionals at Startup Product Talks San Francisco Monthly. Go to sfproducttalks.com to find out more. You are listening to the Global Product Management Talk, a regular broadcast for passionate product professionals that don't get a chance to leave their desk and participate in Product Talk in person, so we bring Product Talk to you wherever you are. Every episode, we discuss different aspects of what it takes to produce successful products. Everyone is invited, including agile practitioners, user experience designers, content and community managers, business owners, CEOs, entrepreneurs, social media strategists, innovation managers, business analysts, project managers, product managers, program managers, product marketing managers, brand managers, software developers, and you, as well as everyone involved with the entire product lifecycle process from inception to sunsetting. Follow us on Blog Talk Radio. Go to www.blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMT. TALK. Follow us on Twitter at PRODMGMTTALK and use the hashtag to tweet answers to the questions and follow the tweet # PRODMGMTTALK. Thank you to our platinum sponsor, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management. Visit them on the web, www.aipmm.com. The AIPMM is a worldwide certifying body of product marketing, management, and team professionals. The AIPMM promotes worldwide excellence and forwards product management professionalism with certification credentials, education, trainings, networking, and professional growth opportunities. AIPMM membership benefits include eligibility for certification, partner offerings and training discounts, productivity tools, career center, mentor matching, advanced access to new curriculums, webinar series, thought leaders, and private events. AIPMM certification credentials allow individual members to demonstrate their level of expertise and provide corporate members an assurance that their product professionals are operating at peak performance. Subscribe to the AIPMM Product Management News and Views newsletter, www.aipmm.com/subscribe. Follow at AIPMM on Twitter.
This is Cindy Solomon. Today we are talking about writing compelling user stories with Teresa Torres, who is Vice President of Products at After College. Product managers share customer knowledge with engineers via the user story. The goal is to write stories that facilitate a conversation between the business and engineering that allow the team to estimate the work so that they can be prioritized and such that the right product gets built. Historically, product teams wrote product requirements documents that outlined every nook and cranny of a product. Some teams still work this way, but many have moved to writing product requirements in the form of user stories. So today we will focus on the necessity of writing user stories that communicate information about the actor, explain the desired action and the benefit to the user so engineers can implement each story without losing sight of the content or of why they are building what they are building. I'm delighted to welcome Teresa Torres as our featured speaker. She is the Vice President of Products at After College, a service that helps college students find their first job or internship. She also writes Product Talk, a blog that focuses on helping product managers be better at what they do by sharing knowledge, building know-how, and refining practice. Teresa has worked as an interaction designer, a user researcher, and in a variety of product management roles from an individual contributor to a vice president. Follow her on Twitter at TTORRES. And like to welcome back Roger Coven as our co-host today. Roger is currently the Principal Product Strategist at Coven, Inc., a consulting company he founded to help companies make smart product decisions. He also founded and operates DadNab, which provides bus and rail directions by text message to transit riders in 10 U.S. regions. Prior to his most recent roles, Roger has led technical teams and served as a software architect and engineer for various technology companies. Follow Roger on Twitter at rcauvin, R-C-A-U-V-I-N. Both Teresa and Roger are prolific bloggers, and I'm delighted to have you here today. Teresa, would you like to add anything?
Thanks, Cindy. That was fantastic. I'm excited to be here.
And Roger, are you there?
I am here. Thanks for the introduction. The only thing I have to add is that I currently am a product manager at a company in Austin, Texas, called Dachis Group.
Excellent. Sorry, I left it off. So I gave a little tiny introduction about user stories and product requirements, but I'd really like you, Teresa and Roger, to give us a little bit more definition on what are user stories, what are product requirement documents, and why are these so necessary tools for product managers?
Yeah, great question. So I'll start with the traditional way, which is a product requirements document. And what ends up happening is that there tends to be a large gap between what engineers know and what the rest of the business knows. So your sales team, your marketing people, your product folks, everybody on the bit that's on the outward-facing side of your business is taking in information every day about the market, about what users want to build or what users want to use. And that information needs to be translated back to the engineers in a way that ensures that you're building the right product that's actually meeting the market need. And what's happened in the traditionally is when we had long development cycles where a product could take anywhere from 6 months to years to get a version out, a lot of product teams wrote what we call product requirements documents. And these are documents that outline the whole product from beginning to end. What is it? What's the product that we're building that is going to satisfy that market need? And you can imagine that these documents included screenshots of every workflow within the document, within the product, outlined what should work, what edge cases should be covered. Really, every nook and cranny of the product was defined in that product requirements document. And what we've seen in the age of internet development, our development cycles have shrunk, and we're developing much more quicker. But also, the market is changing much faster. And it's a lot harder to define a product and have it still be relevant 6 months or a year down the line. And so what user stories give us is that instead of writing, say, a 15 to 50-page document about what your product should do, we instead write our requirements in the form of what we call user stories. And they're meant to represent a much smaller chunk of development, and they tend to be in the format of what I refer to as who, what, why. And so we start with the who. As some type of end user. So an example I rely on regularly is, let's suppose that we were building an event site, maybe something like Evite or a Facebook event site. Your who might be your event host. So as an event host, I might want to do some type of functionality. That's the what, for a specific reason, and that gets the why. So for example, I might say, as an event host, I would like to look up my venue address so that I'm sure to send my participants to the right place or my invitees to the right place. So the who is the event host, the what is I'd like to look up a venue location, and the why is so that my invitees end up going to the right place. And what this allows us to do is really define the different pieces of the product in a much more flexible format that if you're 3 months into development, you're seeing the market change, you can swap out and rearrange user stories without having to rewrite this large product requirements document.
That's a great explanation, Teresa. Could you talk a little bit about the emphasis that a product requirements document places versus a user story on how things, is it product-oriented, is it user-oriented, is it developer-oriented, or are there differences there between how a PRD and a user story orient themselves?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think you're already touching on the first question we want to tackle of what's the value of user stories versus traditional product requirement documents. And I'll say that both of these, both product requirement documents and user stories, are just tools. And a good product manager can write a great product requirements document that has all of the same benefits of good user stories. What I really like about user stories, though, is that if they're well written, they make it very easy to include a few things that I think, in my experience, I've seen often gets left out of product requirements documents. And what that is that when you're, as a product manager, you're very close to your product. You think about it all day, every day, and you start to become blind to your own assumptions about what's going into that product. And it's really easy as you're writing this long document to start to think about your product and what you want your product to do. Whereas the user story format really lends itself to, it's not your product. You're actually writing a product for your users to meet a very specific customer need. And because every user story includes the why behind why you're building it, not just the who, and it also includes who you're building it for. So it's not just what am I building, but it's who am I building for and why do they need this. It really helps to create sort of that scaffolding around that gets you away from your own biases. It really helps you focus on, I'm building this product for a specific person, for a specific benefit, and you get that at the very granular level of each piece that you're building.
So it sounds like, and correct me if I'm misinterpreting your remarks here, but it sounds like you're saying that it's the user stories are maybe a little bit more oriented towards the end user and trying to keep in mind the context around the requirement.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that if they're well written, and that's a big if, the structure of a user story really lends itself to think from the perspective of who you're building for. And, you know, when you're writing a product requirements document, you might have all of the best of intents, but as you start to get into the nitty-gritty details of each screenshot and your edge cases, what should get built when, it's really easy, even if you're a great product manager, to forget some of those things. And when your requirements are written in these bite-sized format that really requires that you start with the who, you describe the what, and then you tack on the why, it really creates, again, I think that this model of the scaffolding, it kind of gives you a template that forces you to remember who you're building for and why you're building it.
I have to interject. I just want to say, do a shout-out to our Twitter participants. Welcome Andy Stitt, 829, Sarah Labsey, Veronica Figatelix, and Greg Garrett, who are making some great comments. And I have to say, regarding user stories, focusing on the who is the user, that would be in the MRD, the marketing requirements documents, traditionally.
Yeah, that's a great point, Cindy, and I think that I'll start by presenting one of my own biases, and that's that the vast majority of my work experience is in the technology startup world, where there's much less of a split between marketing and product. Often the teams that I've worked on, either marketing and product work extremely closely together, or they're one in the same group. But you're absolutely right. Oftentimes in the waterfall model, where you are writing product requirements documents, you're writing it in response to a market requirements document. And the challenge I see there is that you have one team that's defining the context, so they're defining the who and the problem that you're solving. That's your marketing team. And then you have a product team who is defining the what, so how are we meeting that requirement. And then you have a third team that's actually building it. And what ends up happening is that the team who's building the product is so far removed from the context that you tend to, I think this is what leads to products that get built that don't actually meet the market requirement. And what a user story, whether it's marketing that's defining the who or whether it's product and marketing, a user story allows that who and the why to really flow between marketing, product, and engineering and back again in a way that allows all three groups to really be focused on what in what context am I building.
Cindy, any of the comments from Twitter that you want to highlight?
I want to welcome new people coming in, Marie Atema and Ibunomoni, and they're just reiterating that user stories keep the product away from your personal biases, they're more oriented to users, and they represent a smaller chunk of development to what, why answers. Greg Garrett says user stories encapsulate key ideas from product and marketing.
Our second question today is about common mistakes that people make when they write user stories. Teresa, do you have any thoughts to share on that one?
Yeah, absolutely. So you noticed in all of my prior comments, I kind of qualified by statement if stories are well written. And the user story format, as described by sort of the agile community, which is where these really came from, was very particular about the format of a user story. And it really is intended to start with, as an actor, I want some functionality for a specific benefit. And each, I would argue that each of those pieces are equally important. And the biggest mistakes I see product teams make is they focus on the what and they leave out the who or the why. So I can't tell you how many user stories I've seen that start with as a user. And the problem with as a user is that you're not actually communicating any context whatsoever. You might as well say as a person, as a human being, whereas you're missing the opportunity to be a lot more descriptive. So if I fall back to that same example of let's suppose we're building an event site, I shouldn't write user stories from the perspective of as a user. I should write them as an event host or as an event invitee or as someone who's RSVPing. So you can see how that very first piece can take on the context of who am I building for. And if you are on a product team that actually relies on user personas, you can actually create an even richer context by using your user persona. So if you have a user persona that references an event host, you could say, as Michelle, and if that's a really meaningful moniker for a fictional person that represents your ideal user in that role, that can really pull up a very rich context for that user story. So I would say not adequately specifying the actor is the number one most common mistake I see.
There's an anti-pattern there.
Yep.
Where if you see as a user or some very generic term there, then automatically some alarm bells should go off and you need to think about whether you've paid sufficient attention to defining the type of user you're going to have for your system.
Absolutely. So if you see as a user, or my favorite, as a developer or as an engineer, is a really alarming one in my book. It tells me that you've lost sight of why you're building. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't tasks that your engineers are going to want you to tackle. I would argue they don't belong in your backlog of user stories, that you need another way of managing engineering tasks, and that you try to frame as many as possible from the perspective of how does this benefit our end users. So anytime the user story is written from the perspective of as a user or as a developer or an engineer or as someone internal in your business, I would think first ask, can I rewrite this from the perspective of an end user or a customer? And if the answer is no, I would question why you're using a user story format in the first place.
I'd separate those into two separate kinds of mistakes. One is insufficient definition and fleshing out of the who. And then the other one,
yep,
is writing a development task as a user story, or at least,
yeah,
writing a development,
yep,
task as a user story and including it in the backlog.
And I would argue that most user stories that are written from a developer perspective can be rewritten from the end user perspective. So I would say it's most of the time they're not actually developer tasks. They're just not. They're not being thought of from the perspective of the end user. The engineering tasks do come up here and there, but I would say most of the time they can be rewritten from the benefit of the end user.
Okay. Do you see, are there any other common mistakes that you'd like to mention that people make when they're writing user stories?
Yeah, and this is another big one. That's a really big pet peeve for me because you lose, I would argue, the majority of the benefit of a user story by doing this, and that's I've seen countless user stories that leave off the why. So they have no benefit attached to them at all. So it's as a user, I want this functionality. And I think when you write your user stories that way, you're losing a golden opportunity to communicate to your engineers why you're building something. And I think the reason why you want to do that, yes, your engineers can build without knowing the why. But if you communicate the why to your engineers, it gives them the opportunity to, one, understand the context better in which they're building, but also to come up with a better what. So if you communicate to your engineers who's who we're building for and here's the benefit we're trying to give them, they might actually come up with a what that they can build faster, that they can build easier, that might be easier to maintain, or that might just meet the user need better. And so by communicating both of those, you really are bringing your engineering team into the product process and allowing them to also give input on the what.
Teresa, are you familiar with the Apple's Time Machine product?
Yes. Yeah, so Time Machine is Mac software that runs in the background. You set up an external drive, and it automatically backs up your hard drive, everything on it. And then they create this great interface where I can say, I just lost my document. Microsoft Office crashed on me. I lost changes. I can actually go back in Time Machine, pull the document from a half an hour ago, from a day ago, from a month ago. So it has two benefits. One is it's automatic backup without you even having to think about it. And then two, it kind of can also really help out if you lose something. It has really incremental backups, so you're able to go back and pull something.
So here's kind of the interesting question, and the reason that I went down this road is when you look at the requirements for Apple's Time Machine, they've kind of turned the traditional backup software requirements on their head, because initially people thought of the requirements for backup software to be just what the name says, back up the data. But Time Machine actually took a little bit of a different angle on it. They're thinking more in terms of the availability of your data. Not that necessarily, it should be seamless to the user. The user really doesn't care if it gets backed up or not. As long as in the event of any problems, that the user is able to access the data. So in the context of a user story, how do you deal with that? What's the what and what's the why in the user story, the main, overarching user story for Time Machine?
Yeah, that's a great example. So I would argue that most backup software is actually written from the perspective of an IT team. So if I could imagine that most automated backup software is written from the perspective of if one of my employees comes to me with lost documents, I'm able to retrieve it so that they can get back to work, right? Whereas I think Apple took a very different approach, and they said, as an Apple customer, if I lose a document, how can I retrieve it? And I think it's the how can I retrieve it piece that Apple really reframed and did a very good job of, in that if I lose a document, I don't have to go to my IT team because I've got this interface that allows me to really pull that document myself. It's not about data recovery on a hard drive. It's not about knowing when and where in the file system to find it. It really is sort of a oops, oh great, here it is kind of experience. And I think that they really took the perspective of the end user and not necessarily the client. And actually that's a really important distinction, I think, in your user stories, if your customer is not your end user. So I would say backup software, traditionally, their customer has been IT teams, but their end user is the person using the actual computer that lost the data.
Interesting. So we've gone down, we've listed a few of the common mistakes that people make. Did you have any more that you wanted to list before we move on to the next question?
I think the two big ones are really not qualifying the who and then leaving the benefit off altogether, or the thing I see even when the benefit is there is that it's just sort of an obvious. It's not. It doesn't really add additional information. It'll be something like, as a user, I'd like to verify my email address so that you can send me email. It's probably not really a benefit to me, right? And so sometimes that benefit will just be really lazy. And so it's really making sure that you're thinking from the perspective of what's the benefit to the end user and not what's the benefit to your company.
That's a good segue into how to ensure that user stories communicate the why behind the requirement. How do you ensure that?
Yeah, so I think this is really tied to that last question. And I think the first thing that you can almost checklist is to really ensure that every single user story has a very qualified user associated with it. And when I mean qualified, I mean not as a user, not as a developer, but that rich context of which type of user, the who behind that user is included in the story. And then, like we said, the why is really well qualified as well. But two, I think this is where you really want to, as a product team, create a culture where if you slip up, if you don't qualify that who, or you don't adequately describe the benefit, that you've empowered your engineers to push back and to really say, wait, why are we building this and what's really the value? And to create an environment where your engineers not only are comfortable doing that, but that they're encouraged to do that. Because, you know, every single one of us, I've never met a product manager that wasn't a human being, that didn't have these cognitive biases or that didn't slip up or make mistakes. And so I think you want to create that culture across your team that everybody understands what's a well-formed user story, what's the value of well-formed user stories, why are we trying to communicate the who and the why, and that everybody is asking and seeking that information.
Yeah, and in the context or when a product manager is helping to define the product, define the what, a lot, in a sense, they're actually doing a bit of design. They're taking that why and they're finding the best way that the product can address the why. And product managers are not always necessarily going to be the best at making those kinds of design-ish decisions. A lot of product managers are much more focused on understanding the market and understanding the why and the who, and not necessarily the best at defining the product that's going to address all of those needs and users and buyers. And so as a result of that, I think I'm hearing what you're saying about having an open dialogue with the entire team, the developers included, that says, you know, let's make sure we understand the why, and then we can challenge and toss around different ideas about the what.
Yeah, actually, Roger, you're raising a really great point, and that's, I think, far too many product people look at their job as defining the what. And I would argue that a product manager's job, and this is where Cindy might push back on labels again because it does overlap with marketing. But I think that it's far more important to focus on the why and the who and to really define the context, define the problem that you're trying to solve, define who you're solving it for. And then when you do that and you create the constraints around who you're solving for and why you're solving for them, it really opens up everybody in your company to contribute ideas around the what and the how.
That is the intention of developing personas. There's a lot of talk about using personas. And in order to develop a persona to describe who the distinctions between the different users, that forces you to focus on the why and the who.
Absolutely. And here's the thing. I don't think companies need more people having ideas about. There's not a shortage of people having ideas about what to build, right? Every company, every person I've ever talked to, they've never said, we just don't have ideas about what to build. Typically, it's the opposite problem. We have all these ideas, and we don't know where to focus. And I would say a good product team isn't saying, here's what we should build and here's what we shouldn't build. They're saying, here's how we're going to make decisions about what to build and why we're building that as opposed to all these other things. And if you look at that frame in the context of user stories, your who and your why are setting the constraints around what you might build. So if I had to pick between one or the other, if I had to pick about what element I would leave off the user story, I would leave off the what, and I would say I'm going to spend all of my time on the who and the why, and anybody else can fill in the what, as long as there's a way to evaluate, did that what meet the requirements of the who and the why? And I would argue
right,
that 90% of product teams should, that's where 90% of product teams should focus. Like 90% of your product efforts should be, how will we know if the what meets the needs of the who and the why?
Yeah, that's a very interesting perspective, because you could easily get the what, you could easily take a stab at the what, and it might be right or wrong, but have you ever heard of a term called work to rule?
No.
So work to rule is a term that refers to doing just enough to satisfy precisely what has been defined or set forth as the rules and no more. When we merely specify the what in our requirements or our user stories, we run that risk that because of the lack of context, because of the lack of understanding of who we're building for and why we're doing that, we may actually do just fine imperfectly implementing that specification of the what, but completely fail in addressing the real needs of the users. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I love that. That's fantastic.
So let's move on to...
I was going to
have
you...
Did you have something, Cindy?
I was going to have you repeat that, Roger, in tweetable form.
140 characters, huh? There's a concept called work to rule that says you do the minimum necessary to satisfy the specifications. That's the first tweet. I guess the second one.
You're good, Roger.
Okay. I guess the other one would be that if you are, if you merely specify the what, in much the same way as work to rule, are failing, risk failing to address the real needs.
And just to touch on that, Roger, the way what you're saying sounds a little bit like minimum viable product, even though, and so I want to clarify, those are very different concepts, right? So if I understand your work to rule concept correctly, it's basically you're encouraging your engineers, because you're not giving them the context, you're encouraging them to build the minimum amount of products to meet the product team's requirement and not necessarily to satisfy the who and the why. Whereas I would argue the concept of the minimum viable product from the Lean Startup is really understanding what's the minimum product you want to build to meet the who and the why. Right, so that's what we're talking about, the viable product.
Great distinction, Teresa. I definitely did not mean to conflate minimum viable product with work to rule. So good clarification there. When we're communicating the why behind the requirement, we mentioned solving problems for users. Is that maybe a good litmus test for effectively communicating the why, that it's very clear in the communication of the why what the problem is?
Yeah, absolutely. And and this is going to get us a little bit into two questions ahead, but not just communicating the why, but how are we going to know when we satisfied that why? So how are we measuring success around a user story? So that, and I think that when you do that and you communicate that to your engineering team, it helps with that context. So it's not just I built the what for you, therefore I'm done. That gets a little bit into your work to rule. It's we built something. We have a way of measuring what we built in the context of the why. So we know when we've met the requirements of the why, and we can decide as a team, is this something we need to iterate on because we haven't met the need of the why, or we've met the need of the why and we can move on to the next item.
So it's measuring and quantifying the why, not so much the what, but the why that determines whether you've really satisfied the user story in your implementation. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's interesting because I think a lot of people would be tempted to think that what you want to do is measure the what. Measure the what, you know, the what may be having to do, it might be some sort of user interface specification, and boy did we satisfy that user interface specification. But wait a second, when, you know, 90 out of 100 users who tried to use the system could not even finish the story, could not even accomplish the goals that they were trying to accomplish, we'd be in big trouble. So then that raises the question of what are those kinds of measurements? And in the context of a user interface, do the measurements include things like surveys of users or failure rates of users accomplishing their goals?
Yeah, so let's look at an example here because I think you're touching on something that's really important. I think you do need to measure the what, but only in the context of the why. So let's go back to our event site that we're creating, and let's suppose that we see, you know, people are not finishing, they're creating events and they're not finishing them, and they're getting caught up on the venue address. So they're putting in the name of the event, they're putting in the day and time of their event, but when they get to address, they're just having a really hard time with that. So let's suppose that your goal is to increase the number of events that are being created on your site. And your hypothesis is if we make adding venue location easier, people will create more events. So that's your goal. That's your impact. That's the why. We're building this so that it's easier to create events. How are we measuring that? Well, let's say we want to see the number of events created increase based on relative to what it was prior to this change. So you want to measure the why. You want to measure, am I impacting how hard or easy it is to create events? But let's suppose that it has no impact whatsoever. You failed. It just didn't work. You could say, okay, well, people didn't really want venue lookup. It didn't make things easier. But that may not be the case. It may be that something in the what didn't work. And that's where you do want to measure each step along the way of were they able to use your venue lookup? Because maybe you just have a user interface problem. Or maybe the problem is in the what, but maybe the why is still correct, but the problem is in the details of how you built it. And if you correct that, you can then impact the why. Or maybe you were just wrong about the what. But unless you can measure how effective is the what, you don't have the basis for understanding, does this what impact the why? There's a lot of what. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like there's two types of measurements that have to take place, at least. There's multiple levels. At the why side of things, at the why level, you need to understand sort of the bottom line, did this work? But then you also want to be able to diagnose what caused it to fail. So you want to do some measuring, not just around the why, but also some around the what in order to understand what you're going to have to change about it to still satisfy that why.
Absolutely.
I hope I didn't use too many whats and whys.
Yeah, and this is where maybe to get us out of this what-why circle, we can look at it as when you build something from a product perspective, you want to measure the impact, right? You want to know, I just released this feature. How is it impacting my business? That's really that's the measure of why. Did my feature, I had some hypothesis around why I built that feature, and I want to measure, did that hypothesis pass or fail? That's really measuring the why. Then, regardless of whether the answer to that question is yes or no, you do, as a product person, want to understand how you impacted that goal. And you're measuring the what will really tell you that. So, for example, if your what involves sending email, you want to measure how effective those emails were, because it's going to help you get better at writing effective emails, building effective emails into your product. Or if it's not working, it'll tell you what you can do to help strengthen that connection. So I would say with every user story, you do want to look at how do I measure the why, but also how do I measure the what. And I would say most teams are actually very good at measuring the what. With tools like Google Analytics and with Kissmetrics and with a lot of internal measurement tools, we're getting very good at the what. But we're not, I still see a gap in measuring the why.
Are you familiar with the tool Mixpanel?
I am.
For the listeners out there, Mixpanel is a tool that enables you to instrument software with events such that you're able to really track events as they occur in your application, and you're able to sort of put together sequences or funnels of events that comprise maybe sort of a user story or a use case, at least, of a user accomplishing something of value in the system. And I was wondering, Teresa, if instrumentation, if those sorts of funnels, those event funnels, are something that you want to tie into user stories. Should user stories be associated with these kinds of event funnels that you can track and see where the failures are in those funnels?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I typically, when I write a user story, I also add, I do two things. From a measurement standpoint, I define both how am I measuring the why, and that's almost always tied to a product goal that drives revenue for my business. So there's a lot of things that you might do as a product team that don't directly drive revenue, but if I don't know how it's going to drive revenue, I want to understand that connection to revenue, because from a product standpoint, I'm not just interested in building a product. I'm interested in building in supporting a good business. So for every user story, I look at how am I measuring impact, and that impact measurement is always tied to revenue. So that's the first piece I add to every user story. And the second I add is, if I'm not driving that impact, or even if I am, how am I going to get better? How am I going to know what's working and what's not working? And that gets into the measuring the what. And that's when you see things like, I'm going to set up that funnel in something like Kissmetrics or Mixpanel, where I have a sequence of events. And that sequence of events represents my assumptions behind that feature. So if I'm building a feature, I'm assuming a user is going to do X, Y, and then Z. And so I'm going to set up my funnel to measure X, Y, and then Z. And then what happens by measuring that, I can see exactly where my assumptions are wrong. Maybe my users do X, Y, and then M. And that's where the learning happens, where I start to see there was actually a gap between what I thought users would do and what they actually did. And that's where I'm going to start to build up my expertise around my user base and how my users' behaviors influence my business goals.
Sounds great. So we've been covering questions 5 and 6 that we were scheduled to cover, which are measuring and predicting the impact of each user story and how we do that. And then what the value is of predicting the impact of a user story. And it's interesting that the impact of a user story could be looked at in multiple ways. One would be sort of to equate it somewhat with the why, because it's the impact on the end user. But then you mentioned that, of course, from the company's perspective, the impact that the company is often looking for is a revenue impact, at least in the long run.
Yeah, and we skipped a question along the way, which is fine, but that's what connects those two. So I write user stories in the context of themes. So, you know, one of the drawbacks of user stories versus product requirements documents is you can end up with a really unwieldy backlog of hundreds or even thousands, if you've been around long enough, user stories, and it just becomes a nightmare to prioritize and manage. So one way to address that is to introduce themes. And a theme can be, it's just a way to collect stories. And you can collect stories around the who. So you can say, I'm building all of this functionality for this specific type of customer or for this particular end user. You can collect user stories around the what. Maybe you're rolling out a big new feature. It touches lots of different types of users. It touches lots of different types of goals. So you can collect them around the what as well. I prefer to collect them around the why. So what's the benefit of building this functionality? The reason why I do that is that I prioritize my product roadmap based on how is what we're going to build going to impact my business goals. And what that allows me to do is, let's say I have two business goals. Let's pick our event site. Maybe I'm trying to increase the number of events on the site, but I'm also trying to increase the number of RSVPs. And you can imagine both of those could be tied to revenue. Maybe an event host pays to create an event. Maybe they pay more for everybody who attends. So both of those could be tied directly to revenue. From a product standpoint, they can be competing goals. Maybe one thing, building one thing could increase event creation but negatively impact RSVPs. So if I'm trying to optimize around both of those goals, and I'm looking at my backlog of product stories, of user stories, if I'm doing great on event creation, I can ignore that part of my backlog. If I'm just trying to boost RSVPs, I can just pull that set of user stories and prioritize based on how are they going to impact my goal of increasing RSVPs. So when we talk about measuring the impact of a user story, I want to measure the impact on my end user. So I'm trying to get the user to take some behavior, to take some action, because I have an assumption. I assume that that action is valuable to the user and that it's going to drive my revenue goal. And so I want to measure, was it valuable to the user? That gets into the what and the why of the user story, but I also want to measure the company why, and that gets at my theme. And typically...
That makes sense. I was just going to say, if you're grouping things into themes for your backlog, you're doing that for a reason. And a lot, some of it can just be convenience of general conveniences of grouping, but more likely you are trying to make it easier to prioritize. And if you're trying to prioritize, you don't want to prioritize in terms of the what, and prioritizing in terms of the who may or may not make sense depending on the context, but prioritizing in terms of the why and the impact on your business, that's a slam dunk.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. And you'll find, and what I've found is that there's not a very big difference. Let's make a couple of assumptions. If your business goals are well-defined, which is hard to do, but if they're well-defined, and you understand the context of who you're building for, typically the why on your user story, the why to the end user, should be aligned with the why of your business goal. So, for example, if we go back to our event site, if my goal is to have more events on the site, that should be aligned with my end user who's trying to create an event, right? Making an event easier to create for the end user benefits my customer, and it benefits my business. So if you've set things up right, those should be in alignment. You shouldn't see a conflict between I need to do what's best for my business, and that's in conflict with what's best for my end user.
So are you familiar with Dean Leffingwell? With Dean Leffingwell?
No, I'm not.
Okay, well, Dean Leffingwell talks about, he breaks things down into epics, features, and stories, and where the epics are kind of like the themes. The way he treats an epic is somewhat like a theme. But I don't want to go too far into that if that's not something you're familiar with already. The reason I was bringing it up was that there are some, it's to introduce the concept of an epic. And to see if you could explain what an epic is in your terms, the way you use the term, and whether they have any value in the way you suggest people use user stories.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm familiar with, maybe is Dean affiliated with Pivotal Labs by chance?
I'm not sure.
Okay, so I know in the Pivotal Tracker tool, which is made by Pivotal Labs, it's just a product tool that allows you to manage a sprint and a backlog. They refer to Epic Stories in a way that seems to be very similar to what I call themes. So for me, a theme is a way that I collect a set of related user stories. I actually refer to Epic Stories as something completely different. My knowledge of Epic user stories comes from a book called User Stories Applied. I don't remember the author's name, but it's from the early, late 90s, early 2000s, sort of at the growth of Agile, the height of the growth of Agile. So, you know, there's a lot of terms that get thrown around. There's no right or wrong answer here. I think it's the underlying concepts that are important. And the concept that I associate with an Epic story is, as a product manager, I try to write stories in chunks that make sense from a development standpoint. So I want to make sure that my engineering team can estimate a story so that I can then use that estimate to influence how I prioritize user stories. So I'm making an assumption when I write a user story, and I'm assuming that my engineering team can estimate it. There's lots of user stories, however, that just can't be estimated. Maybe it's not defined well enough. Maybe there's too many unknowns. To me, an epic story is a story that's just too large to be estimated, and it needs to be broken up into a set of user stories. So an epic is something that's complex but can be broken down. And so my engineering team will come to me and say, this is an epic. You need to break it into its components. And so epic to me typically refers to a complexity of a user story, not necessarily the set of stories that I've collected around a theme. Does that distinction make sense?
Makes perfect sense. Was the book that you referred to earlier, User Stories Applied, was that by Mike Cohn? Does that ring a bell?
Yes, that's the one. Thank you for it.
And I would say that a lot of the things that you've been talking about do reflect what I read from Mike Cohn, and it's really good stuff.
Yep. For people that want to learn more about this, I highly recommend that book. It's very well written, very clear, and it gives lots of great examples.
User Stories Applied. Cohn is C-O-H-N. Yes, and he has a great website. The Mountain Goat software website has a lot of useful information about Agile and user stories. And of course, Teresa's site has a tremendous resource for that as well.
Yeah, I spent all of September writing about user stories on my blog, and a lot of my writing about user stories was heavily influenced by Mike Cohn's book.
We're coming up on time. Can you give us a URL?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find my blog at producttalk.org.
Rogers is at blog.covin.org. Is that
right? That's right. Thank you.
There was a lot of discussion around the work to rule and the MVP. I want to thank you both for joining us. It was a great education on user stories. We had some great tweets. And I want to thank our platinum sponsor, the AIPMM.com, Association of International Product Marketing and Management, and our broadcast sponsor, Atlassian. Join us monthly at SF Product Talks in San Francisco for in-person discussions. And thank you for our theme music by podcastthemes.com. Visit our website at prodmanagementtalk, PRODMGMTTALK, to see who is coming up, and follow us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Cindy. And thank you, Teresa.
Yeah, thank you, Cindy. Thank you, Roger.
Okay.
It's been great.
Join us in person for lively discussions and great networking with product professionals at Startup Product Talks San Francisco Monthly. Go to sfproducttalks.com to find out more. Our intro theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com and the great Mark Blasco. We are broadcasting live from Studio 132.com.